It's a pleasure to be with you here for the last event of the conference. I'm David McIntosh on the board of directors of the Federalist Society. And the topic for our panel is the electorate in the courts. We have a really distinguished group of speakers here, whom I'm going to introduce very briefly. On my left, your right, is John Fund, who's the National Affairs columnist for National Review and a Fox News analyst. We've known John at the Federalist Society forever. My favorite quote about him is something from Roll Call, that he's the Tom Paine of congressional reform.
Yeah, but look what happened to Tom Paine.
Details. On my right, your left, is former Solicitor General Paul Clement, who is now a partner at his firm, Bancroft PLLC, a tremendously principled attorney, and then also an adjunct professor at Georgetown Law School. And then on my far right, your left, is Seth Waxman, also former Solicitor General and partner and chair of the Appellate Supreme Court litigation practice at WilmerHale. And my favorite thing from his bio was a note that he is a permanent honorary special agent with the Federal Bureau of Investigation. I will. It's appropriate that we close out this session with this panel because the electorate and their role with the courts in modern American politics has really since Richard Nixon's election, when he complained about judges being too lenient on crime, been a topic of political discourse. President Reagan talked about the type of judges he'd support. Most recently, President Obama talked about judges he would put on the court and put forth what's come to be known as the empathy test, individuals who'd be empathetic with various minority groups. I will say, as a lead into the panel, the Federalist Society sponsored some polling related to that and found the American people overwhelmingly preferred the Justice Marshall's view of the rule of courts, that it's the duty to interpret the law and not make it, versus the empathy standard. But I'm going to now turn it over to our panelists and ask each of them to present for about 5 minutes, and then we'll open it up for questions. John?
So good to see many familiar faces who read me or see me on TV, so thank you for helping to pay my salary, which you all do. We're here for a very important reason, that regardless of whatever the polling that is done on this issue that David mentioned, there's a fundamental reality. A large segment of the American electorate and the legal community believes that many judges are legislators with life tenure. Whether that's true or not is not as important as the number of people who believe that to be so. And I think that some historical perspective is necessary here. Between 1901 and 1977, there were 51 Supreme Court nominations. 39 of them were confirmed in 1 month or less. 9 were confirmed within 3 days. As late as 1975, with a Republican president and a Democratic Senate, John Paul Stevens was confirmed 19 days after being appointed. That was a long, long time ago in a galaxy far, far away. What has changed? Many things have changed, but here's just one. In the 1960s, the number of circuit court cases has grown from 21,000 to 223,000, 11 times faster than the population growth. In other words, the growth of criminal offenses in 1960, there were 1,300. In 1970, there were 1,980. 2013, there were 5,000 criminal offenses on the federal books. So as a result, we have a dramatically expanded role of the judiciary in many areas of our life. And then, of course, there's the administrative state, which has become so much the topic of consideration here. All of the alphabet agencies, EPA, SEC, OSHA, you name it, dramatically expanded caseloads, dramatically expanded responsibilities, often dramatically reduced oversight and accountability. And as a result, more and more Americans believe that regardless of what the litigation climate is, that they have to take into consideration not just the courts, but the fact that so many of the administrative agencies are going to lead them to the courts, that they may not have much of a say in whether or not there's going to be litigation. So as a result, we have a dramatically expanded interest in what judges do, and a belief that more and more judges operate not just judicially, but sometimes politically. I don't know what the solution to this is. I do believe that many of the decisions made by judges in the last few years are beneficial. I often side with Randy Barnett, the fact that judges sometimes do have to look carefully at the Constitution, and as is their right, decide that sometimes legislatures go too far. After all, 38 states elect their Supreme Court justices in one form or another. The Constitution itself says that the president will appoint and the Senate will confirm. That almost bakes politics into the cake of this process. Having said that, though, obviously, courts have gone far beyond where they used to be perceived in the public tradition. More and more people tell pollsters that they view confirmation contests as political contests, and certainly things have changed, especially since, of course, the confirmation battle of Robert Bork in 1986. So all of this is about two starkly different judicial philosophies, and this is why people often come down on two clearly separate issues and why this becomes a political contest as well as a judicial set of circumstances, because we have two parties and these are the two philosophies. They are summed up best by perhaps Judge Robert Bork, who in 1990 said, "It is not a cliche to make a distinction between a judge interpreting and a judge legislating. For example, Justice Brennan has said he finds the death penalty unconstitutional, despite the fact the Constitution itself has four times explicitly recognized the validity of the death penalty." Contrast that with the late Congresswoman Barbara Jordan, who wrote also in the 1990s, "The Constitution's framers placed in that document words so vague and amorphous that they did allow for modern 21st century thinking to interpret issues in light of the needs of the time. In my opinion, that is not a negative, that is not pejorative. In my opinion, that is a part of what the framers had in mind." Therefore, it should not surprise us that, as so many legal commentators have said, the electorate believes they're not just voting for a president, not just voting for senators, not just voting for judges at the state level, where they often have a say in the matter, but that the composition of the courts themselves will be decided politically, because so often the perception is that they act politically. And both sides have grievances. If you talk to liberal audiences, they will bring up Bush v. Gore. Not the 7-2 vote in Bush v. Gore, but the 5-4 vote. If you talk to them, they'll also bring up the voting rights decision, which stripped away the Justice Department's power for preclearance in states that had traditionally been under their review since 1965, based on data often from that length of time ago. And if you talk to people on the right, you will hear many, many, many complaints, including recently the case of Obamacare, which, regardless of your view on the matter, you must admit that the reasoning and the argument on the tax versus penalty question was perhaps a bit incoherent and perhaps even tortured. So for that reason, the electorate makes rational decisions. Common sense dictates so much of what the court does is perceived as political. Therefore, people are going to vote politically for nominees who will describe in either vague or specific terms what kind of candidates, what kind of nominees they would make to the federal courts. I hope that someday we can get back to a point where who is best qualified and who is best reasoned and who is most judicious matters more. But for now, so much of the public believes it is all too political. Thank you.
Thank you, John. Our next speaker will be Mr. Waxman.
Thank you, and thanks for the invitation to be here. I view this panel as one of the easier lifts that I have, perhaps reflecting the fact that it is the last thing that is being that you're being treated to before actually being able to go home and party wildly on Saturday night or however you choose to spend your Saturday nights. The topic about, you know, the electorate and the courts, I think the issue was pretty well framed by John. We have a Republican form of government which provides that we have elected officials who make decisions for us, either by legislation or by faithfully executing the laws. But we also have a tripartite form of government that has a judiciary that I think it's fairly well acknowledged is a non-political branch of government, is meant to be a non-majoritarian branch of government. And so when one thinks about the nouns electorate and judiciary in the same terms, it raises, I think, some of the conundrums that John was addressing, which is judges, directly or indirectly, judges are chosen through the political process, and that has to be the way it should be in a Republican form of government. As to the issue of whether they're chosen directly or indirectly, personally, I prefer the federal system and the system that exists in those states in which judges, and I'm less concerned about Supreme Court justices, which is the statistic that John provided, than I am about trial court judges. I think I believe that it's a preferable system to have judges appointed by the elected officials of the electorate rather than directly elected, because it is important to the extent possible to preserve the functioning of the judiciary as a non-political branch of government. On the other hand, the states are sovereign. They're constrained in this regard only by specific constraints in the Constitution, and there is none that applies here. There is just the general requirement that all the states are required to have a, quote, Republican form of government. But I don't interpret it, and I don't think many people do interpret that term to preclude the direct election of judges. So as a policy matter and as a matter of my own views about what is most faithful to a tripartite form of government in which the judiciary is non-political, I prefer the system in which judges are appointed, but appointed by elected representatives. Now, as to the issue that I think is most directly on the table, which is what does that mean in terms of the scrutiny that a legislative branch should give to a nominee of, let's take the federal system, the President of the United States? Here again, I don't think there are any easy answers. I think it is those people who say that because judges just call balls and strikes, there is no room for political consideration of the characteristics of the particular nominee are wrong. I agree with Chief Justice Roberts that the role of judges obviously is to call balls and strikes and not to make up rules except insofar as they are rules governing the procedures of courts that Congress has left to the courts to resolve. But I think at the same time we have to acknowledge that judges are human beings, and the way that they tend to see a ball or strike inevitably, you know, tends from and depends upon their life's perspectives and the views they have about what the laws actually mean. Doesn't seem that controversial in the context of applying some particular statute or, heaven forbid, you know, an appeal from any one of John's alphabet agencies. I thought it was John's selection from the alphabet was sort of interesting. The first alphabetic agency that came to my mind in the current era is the NSA, not OSHA, but perhaps that will enter everyone's lexicon in next year's annual meeting. It really does come down to, I think, judges and justices' views about the meaning of the broader provisions of the Constitution: cruel and unusual behavior, equal protection of the laws, due process of law, and things like that. And it's foolhardy to think that so long as you have someone who swears to be faithful to the text of a statute or the Constitution, you should get equal results no matter who is the judge. And so therefore, I do think that there is a legitimate role for, I'll stick with the federal system, the Senate in its advise and consent function to ask certain questions and not simply say, look, all we have to figure out is whether she or he is a, not a convicted felon who and is in fact a member in good standing of the bar of some court of the United States, but can fairly ask the question whether this is a person. And I think it would be surprising to hear that there would be very many of them who simply cannot put ideology aside in engaging in the process of judging under the laws. I do think that it is fair to ask questions about that, but that is a fairly limited inquiry. And I don't think that the fact that somebody has, once sent an email or a letter or, written some law review article that somebody actually happened to read is a disabling factor. I do think that nominees who have made their lives as ideological combatants are fairly subject to that level of scrutiny. But I, for one, would very much prefer, as I think I heard John saying, to go back to an era in which there was advise and consent inquiry, but it was an inquiry that could be done expeditiously and with a high level of deference to the choice of the politically elected president. I just want to say that I think that in talking about the consequences of the perception of the judiciary and the process for confirmation, I think it's important that we focus not just on the Supreme Court of the United States, which doesn't provide that many nomination opportunities, and when there is a vacancy on the Supreme Court, at least the recent history, if not the history from the beginning, has been to clear everybody else off and work that nomination through. I think it importantly relates to nominations for trial court judges and appellate court judges and the federal courts of appeals. And I do think that arguments about, for example, one burning argument now, which is whether it is legitimate for the Senate to refuse to consider a nominee for a vacant slot on the grounds that there really isn't any need for a judge in that slot, I view as not a very persuasive argument. It is up to the Congress to decide, and the Congress should be superintending and deciding whether we have enough judges or too many judges in a particular district or a particular court of appeals. But if there is a vacancy that needs to be filled, I don't personally think it should be a basis for refusing to consider candidates for the vacancy based on a perception of one or even several individual legislators that the vacancy shouldn't be filled after all. Well, I wasn't sure that I'd be able to think of 2 minutes worth of things to say, but I'm pretty sure that I've extended past my 5 minutes, so I'll yield to Paul, as in most of
Thank you, Seth. I appreciate that. And our final panelist, Paul Clement.
Well, thank you. It's great to be here. What I wanted to do is just, talk about briefly the one obvious place I think that the judiciary and the electorate intersect, and that's in the presidential elections and the effect that they have on the Supreme Court and the lower federal courts. And, you know, I think it's perfectly appropriate to talk about the standard that the Senate should apply in confirming judges and that sort of thing. That's not really my mission here today, though, because I'll sort of take it for granted that however difficult it is, a president will get some of his judges on the courts of appeals and will almost certainly be able to fill vacancies on the Supreme Court with somebody that the president would prefer to have and probably prefer to have more than at least a plurality of the senators. And so I'll start with the very obvious observation that these, you know, presidential elections do have real consequences. And my humble mission here is to just sort of illustrate how that will be, I think, pretty obvious in the next presidential election or two. And so let me just start with a bit of backdrop, which is to just, if you think about sort of litigating in the Supreme Court and the late Rehnquist Court, what was remarkable was the continuity of the personnel to whom you were addressing your arguments. And so we had this really historical period, I think the longest period with a 9-justice court in history, where there was no turnover at all. And so when you were arguing cases in front of that court, you sort of really didn't think about kind of, you know, any new justices and how they'd approach this particular case. In fact, if you went and looked, you could usually find at least one case that those 9 justices had sat on that addressed many of the same issues and could kind of extrapolate sort of what was at play and how the justices were likely to react to your case based on how they reacted to a fairly similar case 4 or 5 years earlier. As one would expect, sort of life expectancies and all being what they are, when you have a period of historic continuity on the court, that tends to be followed by a period where there's some turnover and you have a number of new justices. And so, of course, we've had in relatively short order 4 new justices added to the mix at the Supreme Court. And I'd say from the advocate's perspective, what is probably most remarkable is how little has changed. And so, to be sure, there are, you know, some decisions that have come down differently with the current court than would have been decided by the late Rehnquist Court. And to just pick one pretty obvious example, Citizens United, I think, is a case that could not have been decided the same way because the same issue was in front of the late Rehnquist Court and they decided 5-4 the other way. So it is surely true that there are some issues where the outcomes have varied, but there are really quite precious few. And what's interesting is not just that both President Bush and President Obama did a fairly good job, based on what we know now, of finding justices who approached issues a lot like the justices they were replacing. That certainly hasn't always been the case, but that much seems to be true. But what's remarkable to me is even on issues where I can't imagine anybody was, you know, nobody has a litmus test as to how you approach Apprendi issues. You just don't. And yet the justices, the new justices on the court are voting even on those issues almost exactly like the justices they've replaced. And so I think what this shows is a couple of things that are fairly obvious. One, each party now has really subscribed to a distinct judicial philosophy. And so although there are lots and lots of cases in which the justices are going to agree 9-0, nonetheless, there are some important issues, and I think Seth's exactly right to point to some of the provisions of the Constitution that don't speak to an issue with the specificity of you must be 35 years old to be president. In interpreting those kind of constitutional principles, your judicial philosophy is going to matter a lot as to what results you get, and the two parties really have settled on distinguishable judicial philosophies. And so when you have that dynamic, and you also have whatever else you want to say about the judicial selection process, at least the last two presidents have seemed, at the end of that process, to be reasonably good at picking somebody who embodies the philosophy that is the dominant philosophy in that party. And so that brings me to back to where I started, which is, so elections, presumably, if that continues to be true, will have consequences for the makeup of the Supreme Court. And to give you just a few illustrations of how many various issues that can have a very direct impact on, I just went through and tried to identify the 5-4 decisions in the Roberts Court, since the Roberts Court has included Justice Alito. So since Justice Alito has joined the court, there's been 66 5-4 decisions where the majority was made up of the Chief Justice Roberts, Justice Scalia, Justice Kennedy, Justice Thomas, and Justice Alito. And some of those 5-4 decisions have addressed issues that are incredibly boring. But some of them have addressed issues that I think almost every person in this room would care about one way or another. And so you have everything from the ease with which you can bring class actions, the ease with which you can get into court and sue the government over unlawful surveillance, whether or not the Voting Rights Act will continue to apply differently to covered jurisdictions and non-covered jurisdictions. Campaign finance, as I mentioned. The Second Amendment, which is indeed one other area where probably the change from Justice O'Connor to Justice Alito has had an impactful difference. The partial birth abortion statute, also 5-4, federal partial birth abortion statute upheld by that same majority. Basically, the ease of which you can sue the government for favoring religion, another 5-4 issue. The use of race in school assignments in the K-12 situation, also very much 5-4. The use of race in hiring, 5-4. And then important issues of federalism, also decided 5-4. So as I say, hard to pick an issue that the people in this room, or any other room for that matter, care about that haven't been decided 5-4 based on a majority of the court that could very much change at the next presidential election if there is a consequential change on the court. So maybe that's all obvious, but I think from the perspective of litigators in the Supreme Court, it is something where there are many things that are important in the Supreme Court: precedents, the persuasiveness of the arguments, personnel sort of matter too. So who the justices you're directing the argument to are going to make an awful lot of difference, and the elections will have a great deal of consequence for who's on that court. Thanks.
Thank you, Paul. If you all want to line up, we'll open it up for questions. I've got one to kick it off. And Paul's remarks are a good transition for this one. Starting now, essentially, we're beginning to see in the next election cycle for the Senate the votes on judicial nominees becoming an issue. There are ads being run in Arkansas against Senator Pryor saying he shouldn't have voted for all of President Obama's liberal activist judges. The founders clearly worried about the political influence on judges and put in protections of life tenure and no reduction of their emoluments. Some, like former Justice O'Connor, worry that criticism of the courts undermine those institutions. I just wanted to ask each of the panelists what your reaction to the politicalization in the Senate races of those votes is, and how you think it'll affect the system.
Go ahead. I'll just address it. The trend is accelerating. I mean, we may get to the point in the next couple election cycles where House members who are prospective Senate candidates, for example, Mr. Cotton has only been in the House for 2 years, they will be grilled on their opinion on judicial nominees, even though they don't have a vote on the issue of confirmation. Part of this is the politicization of our entire society. As I mentioned, the government reaches into more and more things, the alphabet soup agencies, NSA included, didn't mean to leave them out, involve themselves in more and more of our lives, and the litigation is, of course, accelerating as the administrative state grows. I would say also that the courts sometimes have a role in this. The two of the cases I mentioned, I think it's fair to say that in the rush of the moment, there were some things that should have been said differently in Bush v. Gore. In fact, they even knew that because they said this case only applies for this time and this place. I think the same thing, perhaps, with the Obamacare decision. And there have been other decisions from the other side that I think have gendered suspicion and fear even among the electorate. So if you have judges who don't write well or clearly or in a way that persuades people that they approached the issue judiciously, you're going to have a reaction, a blowback.
Thank you, John.
I think it's, I agree with John that I think it's a fair topic for debate. I, you know, as a practitioner before the courts, I'm actually increasingly delighted that the operation of the courts and the process for identifying and confirming judges does actually finally in my lifetime seem to be coming a an issue with the electorate that has some traction and gets public engagement. I think, you know, the republic is at risk when, although it is a non-democratic branch of government, the populace is sort of ignorant of the process of deciding who the judges would be and keeping track of what judges and courts do. I think that the increase in attention that, David, that you've identified is a direct result of the completely dysfunctional level of discourse about nominees. I mean, we're in an era in which it takes months and months of filling out forms and going back and looking at check stubs from, you know, 35 years ago just in order to be able to get nominated. And then with the prospect, I mean, I have a partner who is really as apolitical as anybody can imagine, who was nominated by the president for a Court of Appeals position and after 15 months didn't have a hearing. And, you know, was strongly supported by fellow advocates, I'm pretty sure that these two advocates, on both sides of the aisle, and, you know, his life was in limbo with no, you know, prospect. And the fact that this is what's going on in our political system is deplorable. And the more the public becomes aware of that and expresses their views about it, the better.
Yeah, and the only thing I'll add is, though, I do think, and, you know, I make this as an observation about what would be good. I'm not making this as an observation about what one would expect the political process to produce. But, I mean, you know, it would be good if, to the extent judges are going to be topics in elections, that the way that they're discussed and the way that they become a subject of discussion, like, you know, makes sense and actually maps up with the results we want from the Senate. Because what I do think is a potentially dangerous sort of downward cycle is if you get this situation, I think this happened in a presidential election, where, you know, I think this goes back to when President Clinton ran against Senator Dole. And, you know, when some of the Clinton judicial nominees were criticized, you know, the response was, well, but Dole voted for some of these nominees. And, I mean, I do think, you know, you don't, you know, to the extent that the political discourse is going to penalize people for supporting nominees of the other party, I mean, then I think you can see where that's going, which is then you really don't have the ability where, which is kind of how I understood the way the system was to work, which is, you know, look, the president absolutely owns his or her nominees, but, you know, the Senate has got a different role. They should be applying a different standard. So they don't own those nominees, even the ones they vote for, in quite the same way. I would hope that maybe the political discourse could sort of map onto that in a way that doesn't sort of create this other, because, you know, if you're going to be blamed for providing consent to a judicial nominee, then that's going to lead to a result where the senators will apply the same standard on voting yay or nay on a nominee as they would to nominating in the first place. And I don't think any of us really want that.
I'll agree with that. Let's just agree on one thing. The paperwork burdens have become a game of gotcha more than a game or an exercise in trying to reveal
right. Truth
or qualifications. The paperwork game has gotten out of hand. I think that we're going to have a spirited set of political debates about judges, and they're going to be part of the presidential campaign and Senate campaigns. But I do think that we have a responsibility as citizens or people in the legal community to exercise some guardrails. there should be some things that we try to discourage. Otherwise, it gets completely out of hand, and we've seen that happen in the past, as we saw with the Bork nomination. I'll pick one example from each side. Paul Begala, who was a top aide to Bill Clinton during some of President Bush's judicial nomination battles, he was quoted on CNN as saying, quote, "The issue is legitimacy. The president did not get the majority of votes," unquote. Now, if that's the standard, and I realize that Mr. Gore did get more votes in the popular vote than Mr. Bush, but if the standard is the majority of votes, judges appointed by JFK, Harry Truman, or Bill Clinton would have been problematical. If we go down that road, we go to madness. On the other side, when Gordon Liu was appointed for a circuit court position, one of the top conservative staffers in the Senate was quoted in the Atlantic magazine as saying, "We have to oppose him. He's just as smart as Scalia, but not as acerbic. He will be very influential on the court." And if you look at some of the data that's in John Lott's new book, Dumbing the Courts Down, it's very dangerous. Because if we increasingly, good people, choose not to take these positions or not to be have their lives in limbo, we may have a tendency to have more, quote, party hacks, unquote, nominated. And these are very complex decisions that some federal judges have to engage in. They involve science, they involve cloning, they involve comprehensive securities litigation. We want the best and brightest minds. And if the political process becomes so degrading that we end up with the second string, that doesn't help any of us, because judges who don't fully comprehend these issues are not going to give the most informed opinions, regardless of ideology.
Thank you. First question, state your name, and as one of the moderators earlier said, make sure it has a question mark at the end.
Yes, my name is John Zimmer from Arlington, Virginia. It's not just that, it's that politics have become very high stakes, and also that it has become very zero-sum, that a victory for one side is inherently a loss for the other. It's become a giant prisoner's dilemma where everyone has an incentive to defect and nobody has any more incentive to cooperate. This is a very sad dynamic. So what role do you think that judges through public engagement can play to sort of mediate or tamp down this temptation to conflict, or do they just have to sit on the sidelines and say, well, yeah, that's the way it goes, but we're powerless to do anything about it?
I'll just briefly say, if, you know, something will fill a vacuum, and I realize the old tradition is the judges do not comment on their work, they do not explain in great detail how they go about their work, and I understand all of that, but this is a different time, and obviously we've seen changes, and I believe that if judges don't do a better job of explaining what they do and trying to explain to people how the rule of law is implemented and how they read statutes and interpret them, if they don't do a better job explaining that, someone else will try to explain it for them. And that will often be using highly pejorative terminology and highly politicized rhetoric. So I think the old standard is one I understand, but it's probably gone by the boards. And I think judges are going to have to spend more time, and I realize this is self-serving, using the media and using other forums, such as speeches at groups like this, explaining what they do, especially not to people in the legal community, but to sophisticated people and non-sophisticated people who are part of the electorate.
We have a special presentation at the end of this panel, so we actually only have time for one more question. Sorry for the rest of you.
Yes, Roger Pilon, Cato Institute, and I want to pick up on the guardrails theme that John spoke about a moment ago, put my question to Seth Waxman. Following the Bush v. Gore decision, the Democrats in the Senate sat on any number of appellate court nominees from George W. Bush, and the debate that followed in the Senate from people like Chuck Schumer on the Senate Judiciary Committee, Joe Califano writing in the New York Times and Washington Post respectively, were arguing for litmus tests for judicial nominees. And I don't mean just judicial philosophy. They were calling for where do you stand on abortion, et cetera. This is not the kind of thing that will encourage the non-political branch to remain the non-political branch. So when you call for greater involvement of the public in these issues, seems to me that you have to couple that with a call for a debate about them at a higher level than we have seen from some of the members of your party during this period. What say you about this?
What's the question?
That was the question.
I recall your views from before, but
yes, and I mean this is the kind of call for litmus tests for judges that we saw from people like Chuck Schumer, Joe Califano, and others. It seems to me is anathema to the idea of the non-political branch. Litmus tests for judges.
Well. You know, I'm not exactly sure. I, as my earlier comments suggested, it's not my intent here to cast particular blame on one particular party or the other, and it would be easy and perhaps somewhat gratifying for me to, you know, to meet your, you know, Chuck Schumer and whoever else it was and see you three more. The point is that I agree, as Paul has also said, the president is the president's nominee. The presidents get to choose. The advise and consent function is by definition limited. It's limited to the question of whether the nominee is capable of performing the function, as John says, of fully understanding all the intricacies of inventions and patent law, God help us, and also applying the broad provisions of the Constitution in a way that fairly reflects a reasonable view of their meaning. And if what you mean by litmus test is, you know, whether it is appropriate for the Senate to say, look, if this person actually truly believes that the world is flat, can't have them as a judge. That is a litmus, is obviously an extreme example. There are some things that judges, some beliefs that that a particular person may have that renders that person incapable of fairly and intelligently interpreting and applying the law. Short of that, I, as my earlier remarks said, I don't think there should be any litmus test that applies. That's the standard.
Thank you. Thank you, Seth. Thank you to all the panelists.